report this morning. One out from the TTAB, the next from the Court of International Trade, and the last from the Veterans Court. The first case before the court this morning is C&J Clark International versus Unity Clothing, Inc. As I understand it, Mr. McNamara, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You have asked for 5 minutes of rebuttal?
Yes, please.
You may begin.
May it please the court, Stephen McNamara for the appellant. The Trademark Trials and Appeals Board, in the mental error of cases, effectively created a non-rebuttable inference of fraud in any case where there was a false statement. And that per se rule of fraud effectively continued until this court's Bose decision, when in 2009 the court ruled that the notion that the TTAB was applying was incorrect, and ever since then the board has declined to find fraud in a single case, effectively turning 180 degrees from a per se fraud rule to a rule that required an actual proof of intent, an affirmative evidence of intent, and without giving any weight to any sort of inference or presumption of intent.
So how do you get around Bose? How do you get around Bose?
Bose is a perfectly fine case. It's correctly decided on its facts, and it holds within it the seeds of what the TTAB should be doing now, but it's been reluctant to do, which basically says in an appropriate case you review the evidence, you make an inference of based on what is presented, the objective facts, and you may make an inference of fraud, and Bose does particularly express that, but the TTAB has been reluctant to do that. And perhaps it's an appropriate time to remind the TTAB that that inference still can be made. It can be rebutted, unlike in the Medinol era of cases when the TTAB did not really entertain any sort of rebuttal, and that a normal sort of evidentiary process should apply in the same way that we apply the Federal Rules of Evidence, Rule 301, inference or a presumption may arise in the case of some facts are shown, then the other party has the burden of going forward with evidence to rebut the presumption, and the ultimate proof still lies with the party that's presenting the argument, but there's at least a burden to come forward with some sort of rebuttal to the evidence that's
Do you have any support for this notion that it's a burden-shifting framework? I mean, clearly you can make an argument that you can infer intent from the fact that it was knowing, but you seem to argue for this burden-shifting, and I just don't see any case law to support that.
I don't think there is any case law that on this issue of intent that has really raised the issue before, and in it seems sort of, if you will, in the older older CCPA cases, that there was an inference was made based on a false statement, and there was really not a whole lot further discussion of what was the process for evaluating that inference that was made. And perhaps this case is an opportunity to discuss what would be an appropriate process for processing. What's our procedure for this inference? How are we going to evaluate what it means? How are we going to make a judgment whether this inference should stand as inference of an intent, or whether it should fall because there's some contrary evidence? And perhaps we take this inference and we take some other evidence and we put it all in a bucket and we make a judgment. Perhaps we're going to have a shifting presumption type analysis, such as we use in abandonment cases and trademarks, where a party might say, okay, we've got 3 years of non-use, that's a presumption of abandonment, and it has to be rebutted by the other party. Or in patent cases, the latches presumption, that we have 6 years of non-use, there's a presumption of latches, and then the other party has to come forward with evidence to rebut that. That might be an appropriate process to use, and that's what we proposed in this particular case. But you're right, it hasn't been done.
So no other circuit have you seen issues like this, where there's a presumption of fraud?
I have to confess, I haven't looked into the, if you will, criminal side of the case law where you have evidence of criminal intent of some sort and how that might get rebutted, but that might be an interesting avenue to look into. I tried to look into that a little bit, but didn't really find anything. In the same way where you have issues of intent and fraud in, you know, in the financial transactions, we had the robo-signing series of scandals now, and I don't know what the intent process was applied there, but I think that at some point we have this inference of intent that we need to decide how we're going to use it, and that's the purpose of the discussion today.
Even if you're correct that knowingly making a false statement gives rise or would be sufficient to create an inference of intent to deceive, it's still up to the board to say whether or not in the totality of those circumstances that there's anything to undercut that inference or to rebut that inference. So even if we would accept your proposition, didn't the board at least have the fact of them coming back in to cancel their registration? Wouldn't that be, even if I wouldn't think it was enough, don't I have to defer to the board's decision that was enough?
I don't think you need to defer to the board's decision in the sense of that. I think that's a legal issue that's reviewable de novo. But addressing that particular evidence or that they relied on, I think you have two different.
Why is it a legal issue when it? I mean, I'll agree that it's mixed with law and fact, but when they're making a determination of intent, why isn't that factual issue as opposed to purely legal?
Because I think there's no fact-finding that took place in this particular case, where there's no direct evidence of intent, there's no testimony. The sole finding is an inference of no intent that was made by the TTAB based on the fact of a Section 7 amendment to correct the overclaiming of goods in the registration, and that filing arose after.
But it's an evidentiary conclusion as opposed. Otherwise, all determinations made from evidence would be legal determinations.
It's a relevance determination, and what's a justifiable inference determination? And I think that's a legal issue, but I defer to you certainly. And in this particular case, I mean, the 2007 amendments have a couple of different aspects to them. It's not a cure issue because you can't cure a fraud in what's already occurred, but it's been argued that this is evidence, the filings in 2007 were evidence that back in 2006 that the intent was innocent, that it was not a fraudulent intent at the time. And so we're making inference based on the 2007 filings of what the intent was back in 2006. And I think in this case, it's even conceded in Unity Closing's briefs that it's hard to know what the meaning of this Section 7 amendment was. Was it made in order to cover up a fraud? Was it made in order to avoid litigation? Was it a reflection of an innocent intent? We don't really know because it took place after the deficiency had been called out by letter from Clark's saying, hey, your trademark registration seems to have a defect of overclaiming and we think there's fraud. If that correction had occurred perhaps before notice of then I think it's a reasonable correlation to say, well, that tends the 2007 amendment shows it.
Then you've placed yourself on a continuum of interpretation of evidence, and you're running us up against the TTAB's determination. That I think that's where your basic problem lies with both. I mean, and of course we're the three judges here are bound by stare decisis.
Yes, but the Bose does not necessarily prevent making a presumption. It doesn't prevent weighing what are appropriate presumptions to make in view of the objective evidence. And I think that is an appropriate subject for a series of cases to elaborate on what is where the lines are, what is reasonable and not as reasonable.
It certainly takes something that would have been considered outre prior to it and changes it. I'll give you that.
Yeah. And the and in this particular case, I mean, it's a very sparse record, as typical of TTAB proceedings, and it's almost it's almost a law school exam. And so, you know, if hard cases make bad law, this is a very simple case, and maybe it's an opportunity to make good law.
Why didn't you ask the ultimate question? And you've got your request to admit. Why didn't you ask the question? You know, did you intend to mislead the board?
Well, if we had asked that, then we would not have this appeal and this interesting question to address.
Right.
That's for sure. But because at the time it seemed inconceivable that anyone would admit to that, so why ask a question that you know what the answer is already going to be?
But of course, they're all being admitted, weren't they?
Yes, and so that is we wouldn't have this interesting appeal if that had been the case, and in the same way, we chose not to take testimony of Unity Clothing's president, waiting to see if they would come forward with that evidence. And so we have a very sparse record, and it lends itself to some kind of decision, I think.
I note that the discovery closed before Bose came out. Once Bose came out, why didn't you ask to reopen discovery for purposes of pursuing that issue?
At the time that we had the established unanswered requests to admit, and that seemed to be a good enough record that it was worthwhile to proceed with briefing and.
Okay, all right. Thanks for in your report.
Thank you,
Mr. Christensen.
The court. My name is Vaughn Christensen on behalf of Unity Clothing, Inc. This case provides an opportunity for this court to reaffirm the requirement set forth in In re Bose that an intent to deceive the PTO is an essential element of a trademark fraud claim, and that it must be proved by clear and convincing evidence. As appellant acknowledged in the briefs, appellant has failed to provide evidence to support the intent to deceive the PTO element of the claim, and instead seeks to rely on the other elements of the fraud claim to be allegedly sufficient to imply or infer the intent to deceive. And thus, appellant has failed to satisfy the intent to deceive the PTO element of the claim, and therefore the board's decision should be upheld and appellant's petition for cancellation should be dismissed.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, you argue that your opponent reads Torres too broadly. Isn't it possible that you're reading Bose too broadly? I mean, I understand that they say you have to have an intent to deceive, but if you look at page 4 of Bose, where the court was talking about Torres and talking about the case law that Torres was bound by, and then, in fact, says, in fact, they still bind us because they've never been overturned en banc, it cites repeatedly to the proposition that fraud occurs when an applicant knowingly makes false material representations. And it says as long as it is knowingly made or knowingly misleading. As I read Bose, what it was really concerned about was doing away with the concept that should have known would be enough.
I would say that was part of its concern, was to do away with the should have known. It was concerned that the other decisions had lowered the standard to a mere negligence standard, and that Bose was seeking to return the standard to the proper intentional tort standard, which that essential element is an intent to harm, or in this case, an intent to deceive the Patent and Trademark Office. That intention, I think, is what the Bose Court was most concerned had been lost.
Right, but that's what I'm trying to understand, is it's clear from our case law pre-Bose, which Bose itself says it's bound by, that as long as it's knowingly false, that would be enough to establish the intent in the absence of any evidence to the contrary. Why isn't that still the case? How could Bose have overturned that?
So my reading of the Bose decision is intending to take it a step further. It's the key provision that everyone cites to is where it says that we hold that a trademark is obtained fraudulently under the Lanham Act only if the applicant or registrant knowingly makes a false material representation with the intent to deceive the PTO. The discussion and reference to the Torres case was dicta. That statement was the holding. And so the way that I'm reading Bose is it acknowledges many of the good holdings, statements that have been cited in prior cases, such as the Torres case, indicating there needs to be a knowing misrepresentation, but that it also sought to clarify the requirement that there be an intention, that there be an intent to deceive the PTO. And how
would one prove that? I mean, no one's going to say, oh yeah, I really meant to lie. But if it's clear that they knew and they submitted it anyway, and here what we have is an actual admission that I knowingly submitted false information to the PTO. So all you have to do is say, well, yeah, I knowingly submitted false information, but I didn't really understand that I couldn't lie. I mean, under your theory, it seems that you could never establish fraud.
And I certainly don't think that is the case. We do have several cases that illustrate and uphold a finding that there was an intent to deceive. I would suggest...
Cases after Bose?
There is an Eighth Circuit case after Bose. It is Fair Isaac Corp. versus Experian Information Solutions, Inc. It's a 650 F3rd 1139 2011 decision. In that decision, the jury did find that there is an intent to deceive regarding a requested trademark that referred to 300 to 850 mark, which is a reference to credit scores. The parties sought to register that mark.
And they upheld it, and in that particular instance, the jury had no more evidence of an intent to deceive than you have here. It simply had that it was knowingly false, and they just said, you can't just, they rejected the explanation. And here, but it appears that the board never rejects the explanation. And here, they didn't even give you an explanation, at least not one that was admissible. You sort of came up with an explanation.
Came up with the explanation. It was an explanation that the client had provided in response to a motion for summary judgment.
But not in a declaration form. It was lawyer argument, period.
It was. And so that goes to, that really goes to the question, who bears the burden of proof? And under Bose, it's clear that the burden of proof lies on the petitioner, the one seeking to cancel. The burden of proof to prove intent to deceive is on them.
What other reasons might there be to submit a knowingly false application?
Yes,
other than to get something they're not entitled to, which is separate.
Well, the Bose decision itself recognizes that false statements are not always fraudulent statements, and that knowingly false submission can be a mere misunderstanding, an inadvertence, a mere negligent omission, or the like.
But isn't intent, subjective intent, inherently solely within the position of your client?
Perhaps. But I think that begs the question, why didn't the petitioner take the deposition of my client? Why weren't there any discovery requests asking regarding the intent? Appellant is seeking to shift that burden and the presumption of innocence on that element to my client to make it a rebuttable presumption of guilt.
Were you counsel below?
I was. The client was initially unrepresented. We came in after.
When the requests for admission were not responded, were you involved in the case?
We were not.
Oh, okay.
So the client was unrepresented until after the record had closed.
I was going to ask you if that was an intentional decision, but without counsel.
Yes. So to the question of, you know, why should I think really the salient question is, why should this court uphold that Bose decision and find that there is the requirement of intent? And to that point, I would suggest that, first of all, as recognized by the Bose court, a fraud claim, whether it be trademark fraud or any other type of fraud, does require a showing of intent. And therefore, it is an essential element.
But Bose doesn't say anything about how you show intent. In fact, in Bose, the facts were very, very different because we had an affirmative defense of good faith. And so they said, where you have that defense of good faith, you can't just assume that there's fraud. You have to look at that defense. I mean, so Bose doesn't speak to the facts we have here where there's no affirmative showing of good faith. Or no even evidence of good faith.
And that goes to, you know, the point again, so who bears the burden of bringing forth the evidence? And, what I would say is, I don't argue that Bose sets forth exactly what's required to satisfy in order to show that there is evidence of an intent to deceive.
You are claiming that there's a later filed cancellation. Is evidence relevant to good faith? Are you not?
Absolutely. And so, we do argue that the later request to amend and remove some of the items at issue does show an intent to correct the issue, that there wasn't an intent to deceive, that it was, as Bose acknowledges, is adequate, there was a misunderstanding or that there was some sort of inadvertence involved. And so there was, I would suggest that there is at least some evidence that weighs in favor of the fact that the client did not have an intent to deceive because it did seek to correct that registration. Another point that I'd like to bring out is the fact that this is a fraud claim, which does have a heightened standard of review heightened burden of proof. Requires clear and convincing evidence. Which again, appellant is seeking essentially to lower that standard, return it to something that's more along the lines of a negligent standard rather than the intentional standard.
Well, given the fact that there's no way that the appellant or counsel could have been aware of Bose at the time that this matter was initiated and at the time the request to admit were submitted, wouldn't it make sense for us to remand and to allow an opportunity for us to define Bose clearly and what it says and then to remand and allow an opportunity for more discovery if that's needed?
So to that point, Bose's decision came out in August of 2009. The requests for admission were not deemed admitted until December of 2009. And so the discovery did not close until after the Bose decision came out.
So they were not deemed admitted until when? December?
December of 2009.
So it's 30 days. So were they served in November?
So they had actually been served earlier in the year, I believe, in April, and the parties had a stay on the proceeding due to settlement discussions.
Oh.
And part of the difficulty is the client being unrepresented didn't realize that discovery reopened automatically after 6 months and therefore failed to respond after the reopened discovery. But the Bose decision did indeed come out prior to the close of discovery and even prior to the admissions having been deemed admitted. So I would suggest that the opposing counsel was indeed on notice of the Bose's requirement.
What if you know, what is the exact calendaring of that? That is, when did the settlement negotiations interrupt the proceeding? On what day?
I know that the settlement stay began in April of 2009, and it was stayed until October of 2009. I don't have the exact dates right here. But I believe it reopened in October, and that my client at that time had about a month left to respond and to do so. The last point that I'd like to make is the nature of the relief that appellant is seeking, which is that they are seeking to not merely amend the registration to correct it, because that's already occurred. They're seeking to outright cancel this trademark. And even though it's undisputed that the trademark is valid, was properly granted for 40 different items of clothing. The dispute is over these several items, and I believe, as indicated in our papers, that many courts, including the Bose Court, recognizes that the proper remedy for those situations, absent a proof of intent to deceive the PTO, is to simply amend the registration so that it reflects the proper and correct manner.
Why did your client not do that when it was first requested? Why did he not even respond to the letter?
I don't know why he didn't respond to the letter, but he did within days request amendment of the registration after receiving the letter. That initial amendment occurred within just several days.
But it still left footwear in there.
It did, which the client, and it is in the record, represents that it was an inadvertence. He intended to remove footwear, which is why he removed the beach footwear and sports footwear, but inadvertently left footwear in.
But you know, you could read that just the opposite way. Footwear covers everything, so you know, he made it look like he was doing some amendments, but really left it very broad.
Which is true, and that's where it comes back to who bears the burden of proof there, because I would say it's impossible to tell you know, whether it's more likely than not that he was intended to leave it in or if it was an inadvertence. It really is unclear, and I would suggest that it was appellant's burden to prove that it was in fact intentional as opposed to an inadvertence, and they failed to do so.
Okay, anything else?
No.
Thank you. You've got 3.5 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The discovery period, these requests to admit were served on April 1. On, I believe, April 4th, a motion to suspend proceedings was filed by Unity Clothing for a 6-month period until October 1. There were still pending requests to admit. The motion to suspend was filed after the close of discovery. So there was served discovery requests that were pending, discovery closed, and the suspension was granted, so leaving sort of when they came back in to out of suspension, the responses to the discovery were still due at that point.
What is the point of all this? I mean, does Clarks really feel the need to use the mark without the structure portion, or is it just a matter of principle at this point?
It was basically because the UN logo is used identically. It's in the sole of the shoes I'm wearing today, as the UN in a circular thing as a trademark that identifies the brand. Now, granted, this has now been pending for a good 6 or 7 years, so of course, shoe companies move in and out of branding, but it's still part of the line, although certainly less so now than it was 6 years ago. And they do like to have a trademark registration for all of their logos for purposes of registering with customs to seize counterfeits and all the useful things that you can do when you have a trademark registration.
But didn't the board say in rejecting the counterclaim that there's no likelihood of confusion as between the two, so you could continue to do what you wanted to do?
Separately and outside this record, there was a claim by Unity Clothing that the use of the UN on footwear was an infringement of their trademark rights in UN. And so we also have an interest in canceling the registration as a defensive step to say, well, you know, if you say you're infringing your trademark, but you obtain that fraudulently and you don't have a trademark registration anymore, that, you know, you should be asserting against us. So there's also that issue as well.
Okay. Anything else?
I think, as you pointed out, proving subjective intent is difficult, and that we do have to rely on inferences frequently, and Bose case says we can. And the Bose case explicitly states that intent can be inferred from indirect and circumstantial evidence. And historically, prior to the Bose case, and, you know, in cases such as Taurus, that the inference has been made of the necessary intent to prove fraud. And so I think that's all that needs to be done in this case is to remind ourselves that, you know, Bose doesn't rule out the existence of fraud, and the board needs to be reminded of that, because a number of their rulings, such as Information Builders, Daimler Chrysler, essentially allow an applicant to sign this application under penalty of perjury with no risk of any sort of damage or, you know, any sort of loss of their trademark despite making these false statements under oath, and this needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you.